Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Gail Teeter and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information about our show, please see our website at azpodcast.azurewebsites.net. Well, welcome back to the podcast, the Azure podcast, that is. My name is Sujit DeMello. I am a consultant, an application development consultant with Microsoft, based out of New Jersey. And on Skype, I have my esteemed colleague, Cale Teeter. Cale?
Hi, Sujit. I'm also a MCS consultant in the New York region, focused on application development and Windows Azure applications.
Great to have you back, Cale. Well, this is episode number 4, can you believe it? And the topic for today is going to be storage. Some of the storage options available in Windows Azure, as previously mentioned, are tables, queues, and blobs. Today, we'd like to delve into a bit of detail regarding blobs and tables, and we'll talk a little bit about queues. We're going to save queues for a later episode where we talk about another service that Microsoft offers in Windows Azure called the Service Bus, which is also somewhat related to queues. So we're going to club those together so that we can better contrast them. Well, Cale, so I believe you know a thing or two about blobs. Can you give us some insight into blobs?
Yes, Ajit, thanks. So in a previous episode, our episode 2, when we were talking about PaaS, we discussed some of the storage options, you know, the blobs and queues. But I wanted to delve a little bit more in detail on what those are all about. So blobs, as we talked about before, are binary data that we can store up in Azure. You can use these for a variety of different things. And one of the things we do is actually put our podcasts, our MP3s, in blob storage. So it's a great use for that. Some of the things I didn't mention last time, though, about blobs. Blobs can't just be stored directly in Windows Azure. They have to be stored inside of what's called a container. So when you want to store some data up there in a blob, you'll create the container first. One of the primary things that the container is going to give you is some organization about where your blobs are, but also it provides a security boundary. So we can apply things like access lists, and we don't necessarily have access lists like ACLs we have at a file system locally, but we have the notion of a shared access signature, and we have some storage keys that will provide access to these blobs. Another piece along with blobs is the programming model. So we have our REST API, which is what we have with almost all of our services up in Azure now. And that allows us to be platform agnostic. So anything, any client that we want to use to consume something in Azure, we can use the REST API. We also have a very rich .NET API library. And this is great because it allows very little code to be used to do things like upload, copy, etc. It's literally like a couple lines of code to take a file that you have locally and upload it to a blob container.
Nice.
So, as I mentioned, we spoke last time about the page and block blobs, but some of the things we didn't touch on were things like uploading. There's certain challenges with uploading, especially when you have large amounts of data. So one of the big things that we came out with first when we had Windows Azure was the CS upload tool. And that's part of the SDK, so you'll find it in the SDK directory. It's a command line tool. And what it does is allow you, it's a very robust tool for copying a file locally up to Windows Azure. What it allows you to do, though, is things like start and stop. So if your internet connection isn't 100% reliable, which most aren't, and you're uploading a terabyte of data, it's great to have the ability to resume if something happens in the middle. So that's a great tool for that. We have a bunch of third-party tools that you can use as well. I think, Sujit, you mentioned before the Azure Storage Explorer, which is a good tool for that, too.
Yep.
So the one thing about the CS upload tool, though, that is a problem is it's going away. So if you are on the latest SDK, which I believe we're on 2.2 at this point, when you use that tool and you try to use CS upload, you're going to get a message that says this tool has been deprecated, and it's going to be replaced by our PowerShell commandlets. So our PowerShell commandlets we've had for some time now. They've been evolving, and they have a lot of different features that you can do now. You can do everything from creating to VMs to new cloud services. And one of the things you can do with it also is store blob content. The interesting thing about the PowerShell one is it allows you to set a parameter. One of the cool parameters, if you're using set as your storage blob content, which is one of the primary ways to upload data, is there's a parameter called concurrent task count. And what that does is it looks at your machine that you're uploading from, and it will take 8 times however many CPU cores you have and create that many network calls out. So it's going to use as much as it can to push this thing up to the cloud instead of just one synchronous upload stream, which is really cool.
Nice.
And you can control it, too. So if you pass a parameter to it, like a 1, if you pass that to it, it would just use a single thread, and it would just run on 1. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve. So one of the other things that I wanted to mention, too, about blobs was replication. So one of the things, when we first started with Windows Azure, the only feature we had was locally redundant storage. Then later we came out with this thing called geo-replication. So a lot of people ask, how does this work? How do I control it? Am I going to be charged for this? What's involved here? So if you take a step back and look at what happens when you actually store content in a blob up in Windows Azure, what's actually happening when you store those bits up there is, in a synchronous manner, it's going to be stored in 3 different storage nodes inside that same data center. So we're on the East Coast. If I'm using an East Coast data center for Windows Azure and I upload a blob, and when I upload that blob, let's say it's 5 meg, that 5 meg is going to be synchronously copied 3 times inside that data center in 3 different storage nodes, 3 different fault domains and upgrade domains, so that there's no way that there's a single point of failure there for that data. What GeoSync gives you is the same thing except remote. So if you, and it's on by default, so if you go to set up a new storage account, geo-replication will be turned on by default. You have to uncheck that box if you don't want it. And what it does is, when you do that, the synchronous 3 writes will happen inside the primary data center, which we'll call it. And then there's a secondary data center. So if I'm on the East Coast, the West Coast is the secondary. There's a chart up on Windows Azure that will show you what are the primaries and secondaries, so you can figure out where your data is going.
Mm-hmm.
You have no way to control that. That's baked into the system. But what happens there is it's not synchronous, it's asynchronous. So once those 3 synchronous writes happen up there in the original one, you'll get the callback saying, okay, the task's completed, your data's been written there. Behind the scenes, asynchronously, it kicks off a job to write those over to, again, 3 more nodes over in something. So our case was East Coast and West Coast, so it's going to replicate it between those two. Now, you're going to get charged for that. So if you turn that off, it is about 30% cheaper. So the rule of thumb is, if it's really critical information, it should be geo-replicated. If it's not, you know, we do have locally redundant storage, so the chances of that being lost are pretty slim, because it is in different storage nodes. It's just, if that entire data center went down, you would lose access to it.
Now, Cale, does geo-replication also help if you have stuff that is more important to some parts of the world and you know, if you have international customers and things like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. One thing that we struggled with a little bit when we first started was that's what people thought about geo-replication. They're like, well, that sounds like I can tell where my primary is, and then I can also tell where my secondary is. And that's why I made a point to say you can't really target a second data center. It's already coded into the system.
I see.
So we've written a lot of tools at MCS. We've written a lot of tools to do that kind of thing, because a lot of our customers were asking for that. Hey, I got something in New York, but I want to replicate it to the UK. So in that case, we had our own libraries to do that kind of thing. So that's the way we handle that. It's not something that's baked in there. The other thing is, you don't really get 100% control, and you can't use that data in the secondary data center. So when that data is replicated to the secondary data center, think of it as a cold standby.
Mm-hmm.
It's over there, but you can't access it until the primary goes down. So it's kind of like the way our clusters used to work.
Yep.
And still do. So the thing is, if it gets disabled in the primary data center and the primary data center goes down or whatnot, the VIP basically gets flipped and it uses the secondary data center for your all your storage calls.
Got it.
Now, one thing is if you disable it, so let's say you turn on geo replication by accident and you're like, oh, wow, I'm getting charged. Or you come in and say, you know what, I don't think we need geo replication, so you turn it off. That's fine. And what happens is immediately it gets deleted in the second data center. If you start it back up, what's going to happen is, though, you're going to pay for egress. So if it's a small amount of data, it's probably not a big deal. If it's terabytes of data, it's probably a little bit more of a big deal because you're going to pay to transfer that data over to the second data center then.
Yep.
So I mentioned the redundancy in the primary data center and it's asynchronous, but the last thing I wanted to talk about was the security model. So we can make our blobs public or private. That's kind of a really coarse boundary we can put around our blob containers. We can also use this thing called a shared access signature, and what that allows us to do is things like we can time bomb our blobs. So let's say we have something up there that we only want to be active for one day, 24 hours maybe. We can set up a shared access signature with our tools and apply that to that blob, and what that means is maybe we'll make it publicly accessible for 24 hours and then shut down access for some reason. So that's the kind of things that we can do with shared access signature. We can also make things read-only or rewrite. So we have a lot of flexibility there with how we can change how people can access them. And the last point is about the storage keys. So the storage keys are the primary way that we access pretty much everything that we do with our storage system and especially with blobs. And the one thing about the storage keys is we have multiple of them, and we have that so that we can fail over. So if we need to cycle through, if we need to change our primary key, that type of thing. And so that's really what I wanted to delve in with blobs. And Sajid, I know we talked about tables last time too, but I think we have a couple other things we wanted to cover with that as well.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that, Dale. That was a very nice detail into blobs. So regarding tables, as mentioned previously, tables can best be thought of as a NoSQL sort of solution in the cloud. And what that means is it's a simple name-value pair that is available for you very fast and very redundant and very available, but a simple structure nonetheless. And when I say simple, essentially what you get is from in Azure Tables is you get something called a partition key, which you can think of as a grouping for all your items in your table. Then you have a row key, which is a unique identifier into your table, into that particular entry in the table. And then there's an automatic timestamp that Windows Azure will add on to every entry in there. So these three together, row key, partition key, and the automatic timestamp, kind of make up the index for each item in the table. Now, when if you're a programmer and you're thinking like, how do I put data into this table? It's actually pretty easy. They've made it really easy now with the new Azure SDK release. I think version 2.2, I think it was available before that, but in some of the recent releases, essentially there's this this class called the table entity. And all you have to do is to create your own class that derives from table entity. And one of the things that you have to provide is a constructor that takes two parameters. One of them will be the partition key, the second will be the row key. So at very minimum, you have to provide those two. Now, besides that, obviously, you're going to have your own data elements or properties, as they call them, in the table entity or in your own entity. So you could have up to 252 of those properties. You got to remember that they have to be properties. I learned the hard way that if you don't put getters and setters, they don't become properties and they're not exposed. They're not available in the table. So you have to be careful to make sure each property in your entity has a getter and a setter. So once you do that, then, it's just a matter of writing some code. And in this, I'm talking of .NET over here, but it's very similar in some of the other languages where you just set all the properties and then there's a couple of API calls that you have to call to insert an item in the table. Now, querying, querying tables is the other thing that you probably want to do at some point. And in .NET, at least, we have a very nice facility called Link, which is the language integrated query. And what that lets you do is to create almost like a SQL-like syntax for querying the items in the table. So although I mentioned this is a NoSQL table, and it is, in .NET we have SQL constructs that can be applied to some of these tables and structures and list structures. So those are made available through the Windows Azure SDK in .NET. And so those of you guys who know .NET programming will find this a very useful way to query the items in the tables. And then just like you don't have to use .NET, you can just use the REST API. All these tables and functions are available using REST as long as you have the appropriate security key that Cale talked about. And you can call them from any platform. We have Microsoft also provides like PHP, Java, Node.js wrappers besides the .NET wrapper. So, you know, if you don't want to work at the low-level REST API, then you could use higher-level classes and constructs in each of those languages. And, of course, just like Cale mentioned earlier, you know, the tables are locally and geo-replicated as with the usual caveats that he mentioned. So that's sort of the high level for tables. I'll tell you that it's a fun way to program. I enjoyed doing some of the table programming that I did recently. It takes almost no ramp up time. So I really encourage you guys to start looking at that. As quickly as you can, because you could use it for a lot of other things besides, web apps. Tables are useful for storing things in your worker role. You could have web services that rely on tables. There's even providers that Microsoft will give you, which will use tables for their membership provider and profile provider and ASP.NET applications. So there's a lot of advantages you can get out of using tables. So, you know, you should get to know them better. And then finally, Cale, we did talk about just briefly about queues. We wanted to just mention about what they are. I mean, you know, queues are essentially a really great way for apps to talk to worker roles, for example, that you might have in your PaaS infrastructure. You can, you know, trigger some sort of processing logic in the queue. You queue items from one end. There's a standard enqueue, dequeue, and peak functions that are typically available in queues. So those are all available here with the advantage that you can also access them via the REST API. And it's largely meant for sending data from one point to another. It's not really meant as a permanent storage facility. Although, you can store up to 200 terabytes of data, and each item in the queue can be 64K. So that's millions of records really that you can put in there. But it's really meant to be able to pump a lot of data into a queue, and with the understanding that there's something else on the other side of the queue that's trying to read that and flush it out and process all that data. So we'll talk about more on this topic when we cover Service Bus in a later episode. So Cale, we've said a lot about blobs and tables, but do you want to cover anything about, you know, some of the challenges and some of the gotchas and things that people have had to work around to get these storage options to work better?
Sure. Yeah, that's great. One thing I ran into pretty early on with the storage libraries that we have in Windows Azure was about the binary compatibility. So one of the first things, I think it was around version 1.7, when we moved from 1.7 to 1.8, there were actually breaking changes to our API. So it's gotten a lot more stable since then, but we were making a lot of changes back then for performance and a lot of new features. And as we were adding those, we ended up having to make some pretty hardcore changes, which caused the API to break. So it's just something to keep an eye on when you are upgrading your SDKs. Don't do it just inadvertently. Make sure you pay attention to some of the documentation, especially the release notes, to make sure that there aren't any breaking changes when you're using these things. And that's just something from personal experience that I actually ran into. A couple other things that are challenges, not necessarily challenges, but a little bit harder to understand, was how can we get some performance out of these things? So one of the prime cases for trying to squeeze performance out of the storage is when we're using infrastructure as a service and we're running SQL Server on it. So SQL Server is notorious for requiring fast disk. If you want to get a lot of performance out of SQL Server, you need to have a really fast disk subsystem. And when we put stuff up in Azure, we do have, you know, very fast disk behind the scenes, but how can we structure it? Because, you know, in the real world, when we set up a SQL Server, we have a very detailed plan for how we're going to set up our storage. We have our logs placed a certain way. We have our data on a different partition or a different set of spindles. How can we be sure that we're using different spindles up in Azure so that we can get the same kind of performance? So a couple things that's going to you got to think about is we do have limits to how many transactions per second we can do through our storage. So if we spin up, page blobs for our VHDs, these are just like hard disks that we're going to attach to our infrastructure as a service server. We have to keep that in mind. And one of the ways to get really good performance out of that is, first off, you can create multiple of these things. So we can create multiple inside a single storage account. And then we can set up striping at the OS level to go over top of those to get fast performance out of it. So that's a good way, first off, to get performance. But if you want to try to squeeze even more, one of the things you can do is set up multiple storage accounts. So if you create multiple storage accounts and then you attach disk to those and then stripe across that, you'll see a lot even more performance because we won't hit those barriers because each one of those accounts has an upper limit. And if we have more of them, we're not going to hit that limit as soon and we're going to be freer. And the last thing is about durability. So when I talk about durability, I mean, will these withstand reboots and all these kind of things that's going to happen up in Azure? And the thing you got to keep in mind there is when we're doing anything through blobs, tables, queues, we mentioned they're locally redundant by default, and that's true. So we shouldn't have any issues with losing anything in that level. Where you start to run into problems is if you're writing stuff locally to your infrastructure as a service or maybe even your PaaS. If you're writing to certain partitions inside of your PaaS like the D drive, that's a bad thing because if we do move that server, that disk will be gone. Mm-hmm. So it's okay for scrap stuff like temporary files or something like that, but if it needs to be persistent, make sure you're using our storage options for that. Don't be writing it locally. And so those are some of the things I ran into. And Sajid, I know we've had a lot of updates that have come through Azure here recently.
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for that, Cale. It's just been it seems like every week is busy these days with the Windows Azure team, so which is all good stuff for our customers. Just a few updates based on what happened this past week. So, you know, the one thing you talked about is, you know, sending data to Windows Azure. Maybe it could be VMs or blob storage that we want to send up there. And you did mention a few ways to transmit that data over the Internet. But sometimes, you know, if you've got really large data sets and you have them on hard disk, we now have a way where you can, you know, you can ship those hard drives into to Microsoft and they'll store them up. They'll copy them locally for you. Just a kind of a more secure way of sending the data to Microsoft and putting them up in Windows Azure. Talking about VMs, there is now a new VM gallery user interface, and also some of the ACLs for VIPs can be now managed via the Windows Azure Management Portal. And you know, we haven't talked about VMs yet. I think we're going to try and cover it in the next episode when we talk about IaaS or Infrastructure as a Service. But that's what the whole VM story is all about. And then something that's been long awaited, which is the WebSocket support in websites. We talked about website last episode. The two new features that came in there, one was support for WebSockets, which is a new way for programming low-level, like TCP/IP-like functionality, but tunneled over HTTP, which opens up a whole bunch of new use cases. And so now that's available through webs in Windows Azure websites. And also you can do remote debugging now, which is something that you couldn't do before. It helps you debug your website from your desktop itself. And then notification hubs. This is another feature that we're going to talk about in future, but a new addition to that has been you can now it allows you to send alerts to smartphones based on some criteria, and now you could use tag expressions to segment exactly who you send it to. So instead of sending a broadcast message to all Boston Red Sox fans, you could send them to Red Sox fans who are also vegetarians, maybe. You know, you could segment your broadcast a little more. Another update that came up was, and we talked about this before, which is the continuous delivery model, where you use the source control and you can do deployment via source control for websites, and you can also do that for cloud services. Now that's done. Now that's all possible through TFS and Git, which is something that's new. And then the service bus is something we talked about. We're going to talk about in a future episode that has now supports partition queues and topics. And then billing. There's a new billing alert service that sends you email notifications when your bill hits a threshold you define. Especially those of you that use the MSDN account as the credit that you get there. Yeah, this will be useful for you, so you could set a billing alert, when you maybe at $100, $120, so you know when you're coming close to your limit. And then there's a new service called the Windows Azure Cache Service, which is sort of combines all of the caching features that we've had before. It replaces the cache worker role, which was previously in the PaaS model. And essentially, it's a distributed in-memory, scalable solution that enables you to build very highly scalable and responsive applications by providing super fast access to the data that you most care about. And it's available as a managed service. There's the cache service, which is currently in preview. Or you can create and manage the cache yourself using the Azure SDK. That's where you kind of manage all the cache elements yourself. So those are some of the things to look for. Just a few more things, items in here. There's some links that everything will be in the show notes, of course. There's some new Windows Azure PowerShell commandlets. And so if you guys are IT administrators, there's more and more functionality that's in PowerShell that lets you do a lot of cool things with Windows Azure and all your instances up in the cloud and managing them from your data center. And then there is the new Windows Azure Scheduler, which lets you schedule items at a regular interval. Just like you have your Windows Scheduler, now there's a Windows Azure Scheduler for scheduling jobs. And then there's a blog entry that we're going to throw out there, which we came across this week. One of our Azure community folks has documented a way for creating database diagrams of your Windows Azure SQL databases, which is something that was previously not possible because of some limitations in the protocol that was supported in Windows in SQL Server in the cloud. So we'll have a link to the blog entry which shows you how to do that. Oof, that was a lot, Cale. thanks. Anyways, so we're coming to the end of this episode here. And as always, if you guys have any suggestions, any questions on some of the topics that we talk about here, we have a Twitter account now that you could use, and we'd appreciate if you could use that to send us your queries or concerns or any suggestions for future topics. It's Azure Podcast. It's just one word, Azure Podcast. So if you could send it to us over there, and we'll also be posting all the regular the episodes as they come online. They'll be posted to that particular Twitter account. So if you follow that, you'll be notified when things are available. Well, Cale, I think that's a wrap for us. Anything you want to say?
No, I think this is good. These updates, keep coming faster, so it's good to see that things are changing up there very fast, and hope people are able to take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Cale, for your deep insights into some of these topics today, and we'll see you guys next week. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use the comments section of the website at easypodcast.azurewebsites.net. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.